Welcome to A Reader's Community. What you're about to hear is a live recording of a book club I hosted a few weeks ago with Alistair Mackay. It took place at the book lounge, and we talked about Alistair's novel, It Doesn't Have to Be This Way. This is a brilliant, queer, speculative fiction novel set in the very near future, and it follows three main characters, Viwe, Luthando, and Malcolm, as they deal in different ways with fast approaching climate collapse. This book is unsettling in the best way, as only cli-fi can be. It's propulsive and absorbing, and it's also a brilliant love story. I thought this event was a great example of what happens when a community of readers get together, and everyone asks such good questions. Here's the recording. Welcome everyone to the second ever A Reader's Community Book Club. It's very nice to have you all here. We just launched another season of the podcast, and this is the second event like this I'm doing. The last one was last year, but the last season. And podcasting is super nice in that I get to talk to the people that I'm talking to on the podcast, but I don't really get to interact with other people beyond that. So it's very fun for me to be in a whole room full of readers instead of just talking to one person at a time. So I really appreciate you coming. And we're lucky enough to have Alistair Mackay here for this event. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. Yay! Thanks, guys, for being here. This is really cool. Thank you, Fasti.
I'll just say something about the format of the event before I open up with questions and a bit of housekeeping. So this is a book club. It's not a launch. It's a conversation between all of us. So I'll warm us up, but then the idea is that the questions then come from you. But I will also step in if you can't think of a question. I think a lot of you have read the book. Some of you might not have read the book. And then because it's a book club and not a formal book event, we can also help ourselves to wine throughout the event. So feel free to get up and get some more wine. Just be, you know, discreet. Knock over chairs and stuff on your way. And then this is being recorded because we may or may not use the audio. Audio from live events is a little bit variable, so we'll see how it turns out. But if you want to ask a question but don't want to end up on a podcast, please don't let that stop you from asking a question. Just tell me afterwards that you don't want to end up in the recording and we will edit you out. And then I'll just make sure to make a note of everything you said and we'll cut it out. And then the last thing I want to say is that if you're here because of Alistair and not because of the podcast, which I'm sure many of you are, please give the podcast a listen. And if you're interested in this book, you may be interested in an episode we did on queerness and spec fic that came out last year. But maybe you'll be interested in everything that comes out this year as well. So give it a listen. It's available everywhere. Okay, so to start us off, Alistair, can you tell us what the book is about for those who haven't read it or who read it a whole year ago when it came out?
Yeah, and to remind myself, because it's been a year since it came out. So the book, It Doesn't Have to Be This Way, it's a climate change dystopia, broadly. It follows mostly three queer friends in Cape Town as things start to deteriorate and the ocean level rises and the heat gets worse and the droughts get worse. And sort of society starts to fall apart around them. And it follows their journey over a period of 15 years from now to 15 years into the future and their relationships. And so Cape Town becomes divided between the haves and the have-nots. Most of Cape Town is a slum. It's, you know, investment has retreated. A lot of people have retreated. The wealthy have retreated to a private city state called the Citadel on Signal Hill. Which is in a climate-controlled dome, and everybody there just spends their life blissfully unaware of what's going on all around them. A lot of them are plugged into augmented reality all of the time, because technology has progressed in the next 15 years as well, and people have lenses in their corneas where they can just opt out of life, basically, and just be on social media or in virtual reality. And then there's a storyline which the book bounces between, so it's kind of, there's almost like a sense of like a countdown, so it bounces back and then forward to 15 years in the future. And the storyline of 15 years in the future is centered on a little boy called Milo, and he's looking for his parents and he doesn't know where they've gone. And then it goes back in time to our time and it tells the story of the three, Luthando, Malcolm and Viwe, and their stories as we get to that point in the future.
I loved it. I reread it for this, obviously, and I read it, I think, before it came out last year, which is quite a while ago, and I loved it even more in the second reading.
Thank you.
It's so vivid in terms of, like, a climate fiction book, and I think part of it is because of the quality of the writing, which is so good, but also because it's in Cape Town. So there's just something that hits different about like hearing Table Mountain described on as like being in flames, and hearing that the water level has risen back to Strand Street where it used to be before like all the terraforming. Yeah, so it's so specific and impactful. And so like, so this hit me like no other climate change or climate catastrophe book has ever hit me before. And I was thinking about how, more so than with other kinds of genres or other kinds of books, climate fiction kind of seems to be given this responsibility. Like people have this expectation of it, that it's, that it has to have the right effect in the reader. Like it has to like hit the right note of what you might call like positive panic. So like urgency, but not paralysis and not nihilism and despair. Like yeah. you want people to be not complacent, take action, yeah, but not be paralyzed by fear. But I think it's weird about climate fiction. Like I think it's, we don't tend to expect that from fiction, like that it has this particular effect. Like we almost treat it like science communication or like it's supposed to be didactic or like you actually have a team of climate scientists and you're just the artist member of that team. That's how people talk about it. Did you feel that pressure? Like have people responded like that to this book?
Yeah, totally. Also, I love that term, positive panic. I think that's...
I got it from a YouTube channel, so okay. I can give credit to you.
I think that's exactly the balance I was trying to strike of like, because it is part like cautionary tale and saying, you know, this is the path that we're on and this is where it ends up. And so let's not choose that path. But you don't want to swamp the story and you don't want to lose sight of the characters. And it's all about like, I hope, falling in love with the characters and realizing and you know, living with them through this journey, you know. So it's quite hard to get that balance right. And I think people, depending... You know, there's this thing about books that once you've written it, it then belongs to the reader. It doesn't belong to you anymore. And so for different people, it'll be a different balance. Some people have said they felt inspired by this book and like galvanized into action and they think about climate change stuff so much more. But some people have said they felt completely terrified and overwhelmed and had nightmares. So.
Yeah, but on that end, we have to talk about your timeline. So, yeah. In the book... The only actual date that's given is 2028, which is the year that the wine farms, the last year that wine farms produce wine, because after that they're just...
Drink up,
just,
everyone.
Yeah, it's just isolation. Yeah. 2028 is 5 years away. Yeah. So I think a lot of my like urgency came from that timeline. So yeah. What was your calculation? Did you have an emotional calculation of the timeline?
Yeah, I guess the timeline, it's a tricky one. So I think... When I started out, I did want to condense it a little bit and accelerate things a little bit for the sake of the story. I think often people think about climate change, it'll just be the next generation that has to deal with it. We don't have to think about this yet, you know. So part of the reason why I have a child narrator in the future is that, you know, these children are already being born. They're already around for these people that we're just saying, well, you're going to have to deal with this. But I also think that the climate science is changing all the time and things unfortunately seem to be maybe a little bit worse than the initial predictions predicted. And so, you know, like last year, Europe had temperatures that weren't predicted until the 2050s. So I had planned on condensing the timeline down into sort of one generation, stuff that might take two or three generations in reality. But the science seems to be shifting and maybe it's getting worse faster than we anticipated. It was also in aid of, as you say, of sort of trying to freak people out a little bit and think, okay, this is actually very serious. But not to the point of feeling apathetic because that's the last thing I wanted.
No, I mean, I think it really did that for me. Like, we must save the wine farms. Amongst other things. So as you mentioned, it's a character-driven story. It's a love story. Mm-hmm. But the climate catastrophe aspect of it is really relevant for the relationships as well. And I thought it was very interesting how Viwe and Lutando and Malcolm all have different ways of dealing with their anxiety around climate change. And that can be a site of connection between people, but it can also be a site of disconnection. And I think that's really interesting in intimate relationships, like when commitment to a cause or passion for a cause or fear of something abstract, or not abstract, but outside of the relationship becomes so relevant to the interpersonal relationship. Could you reflect on that? Like, what did you, like, how does it emerge in the book? What do you think about how that plays out in life?
Sure, that's a big question. I think it does. Yeah, I think it has a very big impact on their relationship. So Lutando and Viwe are in a romantic relationship for a lot of this book, and Lutando is much more of a sort of an idealist and a fighter, and he sees what's happening and he really tries to sort of change the course of history, and he becomes an eco-activist and then becomes quite radicalized. Whereas Viwe starts just feeling very overwhelmed by what's happening in the world and sort of retreating into himself and feeling very afraid. And I think both of those reactions are pretty relate. I mean, I wrote these characters, so I guess they're relatable, relatable reactions.
I also find them relatable.
And it does put a strain on their relationship because I think Viwe feels a bit alienated by Lutando's determination and like unwillingness to just go with the flow. But they also find ways to support each other and to sort of re-inspire each other. It's a complicated dynamic. I don't know if it's static. I think it's, in some ways, it makes people feel alone when they are the only one in a relationship who thinks things are as bad as this and is fighting for change. But then sometimes they rely on their partner, who's maybe not as involved. So, I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah. No, it does. I also, I've listened to a bunch of podcasts about like families that fall apart around that kind of asymmetry in like passion for a cause. I think it's very interesting. Viwe and Lutando don't, it's not that bad for them. It's just like bits of things that are withheld from each other because they're not on the same page with regards to this.
And with Malcolm as well, because he's sort of the most privileged of the three characters and he can kind of opt in and opt out of the different fights. And ultimately that doesn't serve him very well. He feels very isolated and very lonely by the end because he's kind of given up on interpersonal relationships.
Okay, I'll ask one more question and then I'll open it up to the floor. But so this is set in the future, the near future, but it's not a reality. It's not the reality that we occupy. There's big differences between this world and this world. But there are some things that are like, we are so close to it. Like it's such a plausible trajectory. And a lot of the beginnings of those trajectories are already with us in the present. And I'm thinking about, some of the more like ideas about what the future will be like in general, like the technological innovations, but then also in terms of that Cape Town ends up stratifying in that way, that like the privileged are managed to build this climate controlled dome and they're completely oblivious about what's going on outside of them. And it's so close to, it almost feels like a metaphor rather like more than just a possible hypothetical future. So I think in a lot of ways, the book is good at critiquing the present moment by imagining a future. Is that something you wanted to do?
Totally. So I think part of the inspiration for the book, so I was chatting to you a bit earlier, I was working on this novel in my MFA when I was living in New York, but it's very different from that book now. But when I came home, I was sort of struck again by like the inequality in South Africa and this dynamic that you're talking about how the middle classes sort of isolate themselves. And so I think it is kind of what's going on in South Africa already, like gated communities and everyone winding up their windows at robots and that kind of stuff. And people prefer to look away and to not deal with the suffering that's happening all around them. And there's that quote about like, it's dystopian if it's happening to us rather than them. So this book does, I think a lot of speculative fiction puts a lens on current issues by using the future as almost a metaphor. You know, it makes it less, I think it lowers people's defenses a bit. They don't feel so defensive when they're reading about it. They're like, and then they can see, actually, this is kind of what we're living already. It's just not this exact formation of it.
Yeah, it's kind of taking it to its logical conclusion.
Like extrapolating the trends, totally. Yeah. If things get worse in this direction, this is how it'll end up.
Does anyone have a question yet? Should I keep going for a bit? Yes.
I have a question. Fortuitous timing, because it kind of builds on what you just said. But, I remember finishing the book late at night and then immediately driving home, like kind of across town, and just being terrified by everything. Like the wind was terrifying, the darkness was terrifying, the town was pretty much empty, was terrifying. I drove past the castle where there's all those people living on that little island over there. Just terrified by just everything that was around me. But it was also, I appreciated that experience of being terrified because it was like, did flick a switch of being like, you're living in this moment now. But the question I have is, what is it like for you to spend so much time in that headspace? Because I imagine you must have tried to inhabit that terror to be able to communicate properly. What is that like?
Well, firstly, I'm glad it had such an effect on you. That's always nice to hear. I'm always in that headspace. So for me, it was like quite cathartic to like try and share this burden with the rest of the world. Because I'm a very anxious person. I do feel very anxious about climate change and how we're all kind of just sleepwalking into it and no one's doing anything about it. So yeah, it's in a weird way, writing the book helped me expel some of that and feel less, I don't know, maybe I just pushed it onto everyone else. I'm not sure what happened there, but it is also quite weird to be like, especially when I was actively working on writing it and like thinking about these characters and what's going to happen next in their lives, and then like going to like a dinner party. It's quite a strange disconnect. And also the relief that came from writing it down has gone away. So now I'm anxious about it all again. So we're in the same boat now.
Does anyone else have a question?
Following that question and related to what you were saying about living in families or communities where, you know, one part of them might be passionate about a particular cause, did you find that writing this book and kind of putting it all out there moved some of the people in your life or the communities in which you find yourself, that discussion, or there was further understanding not only on climate fiction but a whole lot of the other kind of themes that we've already chatted about? Did you find there was a real shift in the people around you as a result of your work?
Yeah, I think I did. I think a few people were surprised that I had such dark stuff in my head, like, to your point. So I think on various aspects, as you say, like I think a lot of people have said to me, you know, they hadn't thought so much about climate change or how it's going to affect South Africa. And I think a lot of this is going to get very personal, very deep, but I think a lot of the queer trauma in this book as well was quite eye-opening, especially for like family members and for straight friends who hadn't maybe thought about this stuff so much. Because Vire's storyline is again, not my storyline, but it's a lot of that shame and self-loathing and all of that stuff is stuff that a lot of queer people grow up with. And so I was extrapolating that as well, also into like a very religious family and a increasingly stressful societal situation. But, you know, those kind of truths at the heart of it, I think, did like surprise a lot of people and made them think about things. And a woman in one of the Joburg events said to me, and this sounds like a problematic thing that she was saying, but it wasn't problematic. Like, her tone and everything was actually really beautiful. And she was just like, I'd never really thought about gay people as people. And like, it really helped me just like understand the psychology of like growing up like that. And so those kind of moments were actually really touching for me. Yeah. I'm probably not conveying exactly the way she said it. It didn't feel like a hateful thing at all. It felt like I hadn't really thought about this before, and I'm so glad I have thought about it, and now I see. Yeah. Anyway.
But I was thinking about the intersection between queerness and spec fic.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about how like queerness can inform spec fic. That's kind of what I was more interested in. But now that kind of seems like a way in which spec fic speaks to queerness. I mean, just in that, like, if people are spec fic fans and there are gay characters in the spec fic, then they read a book about gay people that they wouldn't have read otherwise.
Yeah.
Has that happened, like, more than that one lady in Joburg?
I think it's definitely, because it's such a weird genre blending book and no one knows where to put it in bookshops. like, is it queer literature? Is it like science fiction? Whatever. It has like, people who are drawn to it because of the sci-fi or the cli-fi elements maybe wouldn't have necessarily read a queer story, and people who are drawn to it because it's a queer story maybe wouldn't have read about climate stuff before. So I think it has sort of cross-fertilized ideas, which is quite cool.
That is cool. What do you think, like, what is productive between queerness and spec fic, like, conceptually? Like, what promises can it offer to bring those two things together? Or what did you find, like, how did they enlighten each other for you?
So it's something that I had to kind of figure out as I was writing it. I don't think I had like a theory when I started out, but it kind of emerged for me as I was writing it that I think a lot of the stuff that's kind of really damaging to our ecosystems and to our economy and all of that stuff is a similar paradigm that results in queer people being like demonized or stigmatized or whatever it is. There's like this domination impulse and this very like masculine thing of like, we've got to take over the world or like, kind of inherited it from the colonial era, you know, of just like take whatever's in front of you, don't care about anything, and denigrating like nurturing and kind qualities because they're not like mask. So I think on the one hand, I think there is actually just a connection between like queer oppression and general societal collapse. But I also think that queer people maybe have because we were outsiders growing up, we have like a different perspective on things, and we can maybe see some of the problematic structures in society more clearly than people who weren't sort of forced to the periphery. And I guess we've been experimenting with alternative like family structures, and there's just less, I guess we're not sort of channeled into the same ways of thinking in the same way that a lot of the straight people are, which is quite traumatic when it happens, but it's actually a gift at the end of the day, because you, I don't know, have a broader perspective. And I guess speculative fiction in general is about imagining a different way of being. And so maybe, I don't know, queer characters help with that.
Yeah. I was, where's Colin? So I'm going to quote you, but I feel like it's weird to do it without a horse in the room. So Colin said something very smart about queerness and specfic, which is, he was saying that homophobia is a failure of the imagination.
I love that.
Yeah, and that queer people already know that the way things are structured now, like, it cannot be the way that it ought to be structured, or the way that it will be structured for all eternity. Like, queerness and imagination for alternative futures work really well together.
Totally.
Yeah. Does anyone else have a question?
Can I just add, it's kind of linking to what you were saying earlier, that, I mean, Carmen Miawa Chado, who I'm sure some of you might know, but she writes a lot of, like, I guess, queer horror. I guess that would be the easiest way to describe her. But she's lesbian, and she really enjoys writing from that place. And it struck me when you were saying, I was just scared all the time, because what she said is, like, being like queer, you experience the world from a different point of view, where you are scared, or you take things from a different perspective. And it's just linking to what you were saying about, like, how we see the world differently in so many different ways. And, like, you know, your chosen family becomes like something else compared to like your usual family. And I just really loved that. I thought it was really, really cool. But it also just made me, like, think, I guess, why, like, how am I gonna say this? Okay. Like, when you were dealing with that, was it kind of intentional that you were thinking, okay, we need these three queer characters to explore this? Or did it kind of happen by the fact that you were like, these are the three main strands that I was thinking about. This is where I would put myself. And then how did those characters become gay? Like, how did those characters become queer? Like, where, at what point was it like, oh, this is where I want to see the world from?
Thanks for that.
Not a planted question. I know I'm the husband, but I know.
And my answer probably won't be very slick, which will prove that it wasn't a planted question. because I don't know how other writers work, but I just kind of throw myself at a project, and I have this urge that I need to just write it, and I can't really make sense of it. And so it wasn't like I was checking things off a list. It was trial and error, kind of. And so I think part of why I wanted to write queer characters was just so that I could put some of my own experience into this. And I have an ex-boyfriend whose story is very similar to Viwe's, not as dramatic, but and I kind of wanted to explore some of that stuff. I think I'm interested in kind of the fact that when society starts feeling unstable, often there's a lurch towards the political right, and like it's often like anti-immigrant or anti-woman or anti-LGBTQ. And we've seen that happening more and more already in recent history. And so I kind of wanted to explore what it feels like when things start going wrong and you're also a marginalized group. I was just drawn to that lens on kind of this stuff. I feel like I've forgotten part of what you asked me. No, is that it? Okay. Right.
I also have a question about writing from different perspectives. So Milo is a child. How old is he actually? I don't know. Like 9 or something.
I think he's 9-ish. Yes. Yeah.
I read this like yesterday. Anyway. And then Lutando and Vera and Malcolm are the other perspective characters that we see some of the story from their perspectives. So Lutando and Vera are black characters, both queer men, and you're a white adult man. what did you have to keep in mind when you were writing from perspectives that were not your own, like both Milo and Lutando and Vera?
So I guess Milo's weirdly was the easiest for me. There's something quite freeing about writing from a child's perspective. It kind of just lets you inhabit a space of innocence, and it's also just quite a useful lens on looking at the world, because children haven't been conditioned into thinking everything's normal, so they don't think really anything's normal or not normal. So you can kind of show things which are really abnormal, and a child's perspective on that is super interesting. So he was quite. I really enjoyed writing Milo's storyline. It felt very, like it freed me up to feel a lot of kind of sadness and grief, but also hope and the innocence stuff. Lutando and Viwe, the short answer is that I was very stressed about it. this is such a minefield, you know, like white writers writing black characters is very, very topical and very important to discuss. Also terrifying as a white writer. So because this book is a lot about social issues, I didn't think it would feel really weird to me if it was only told from white perspectives.
Yeah.
I think it was really important to have black perspectives and to look at both sides of the privilege divide in this book. And so then I guess it's a question of how do you do that in a way that shows kind of empathy and compassion and like so that the characters are whole and not caricatures or whatever. So I guess my approach was to try and put a lot of myself into each of the characters and then really try my hardest to imagine how things are not my own experience and how things differ from my own experience and what effect that would have on my experience of what's going on in the book. And a really easy example. So Lutando does a lot of guerrilla gardening in the book. He plants trees all over Cape Town. I've done that. and it made me very anxious at the time. And then I was thinking, fuck, imagine also being a black guy in this situation. I would feel so much more unsafe and like people are going to turn on me. So, I guess that I don't know what the answer is. I felt very, very aware of the fact that I was doing something that not everyone approves of. But I do think fiction requires that we are able to inhabit other people's views.
Yeah. Any questions? Oh, Colin.
A follow-up on that. What has the response been from black readers, specifically black queer readers, if any, on how you portray those characters?
I haven't had any hate, which I guess is good. I mean, no one's really said much to me in the events that I've gone to. I think one of my black, I mean, admittedly she's a friend of mine, so she would be nice to me, but one of my black friends told me that she found it really like beautiful how I was able to inhabit, you know, the different perspectives and that it didn't feel very one dimensional, but yeah, admittedly she wasn't just a stranger. So, but I'm hoping that if people did have a problem with it, they would tell me and I could, you know, improve the way I handle this in future.
No, I'm asking this because I'm exactly in your situation where I don't want to write in a way that centers whiteness, but
yes.
I also don't want to overstep the mark.
Yeah.
So I was just kind of curious to see what would have been a back and forth hypothetically with the readership, whether people felt seen or felt used to something or I don't know.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. So I think you were asking about like once the book was published, but before the book was published, I did share early drafts with some black friends, and then I had sensitivity readers at a later point as well. So there was a back and forth.
Okay.
Too old to see.
So preemptively.
Preemptively, yeah.
Which I think. But I think it's also I think the way that you write whiteness is also very good in this book. Like Malcolm's privilege, like it's so clear how it influences his decisions, but also like that it's not good for, like, and it's ultimately not good for him. Like it puts him somewhere where he doesn't want to be. Like the like resulting isolation and how morally compromised he ends up being is, which I think, do you think that was, I don't know how to put this, maybe enhanced from all of the like other work you had to do to imagine other perspectives? Because I think like as white people, our whiteness is invisible to us so much of the time, as is our privilege. And maybe the practice and empathy, it makes it easier to see that from the outside. I don't know, or not from the outside, but to make it visible.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I think it probably did help a lot. I think it also helped, again, living overseas and then returning home, because I think our whiteness is less invisible to us here, because it is in contrast to other people's experiences, and that's quite quite visceral sometimes. And it's also just Malcolm was quite freeing to write as well, because he enabled me to lean into some of my worst traits. and like I also like want to distract myself and withdraw and retreat and feel like I think I might be a little bit cowardly about joining a very like raucous like protest or whatever it is. And he's able to do that because he has the privilege, and it's not like whereas Viwa and Lutanda feel like they don't really have a choice. So I guess with him, maybe it's just about, and I think this is true with writing all characters, right? You don't pull back, right? Just like try and figure out what the ickiest feeling is that you have and just put it on the page, you know?
Yeah, I love that. Yes.
I have a comment and a question. I think the comment was, based on what you said, we're like, what can we learn from queerness into climate fiction or just climate science or anything? And I actually found the book really hard to read because of being constantly reminded of how fucked Cape Town can get.
Yeah.
And if I'm sort of like, oh, I'm going to sleep now, I want to read about something, I'm not sure I want to be sort of reminded about how dystopian it's possible to get. But when you asked that question, I thought to myself, I was like, and it's difficult to be optimistic in South Africa at the moment, just with the political situation. And we and a lot of different people that we're speaking to with our friends, that's a hard thing to do. I think that arc of like how queer people are seen now compared to 10 years ago or 15 years ago is actually really inspiring. And that way of being like, I remember coming out when the whole American gay marriage discussion was happening in the Supreme Court, not discussion, litigation, was happening in the Supreme Court, and how now that seemed like so far in the distant past, and it's so obvious that that's probably not going to get rolled back, at least in most states. And I almost see that as like a hopeful arc of like, in the same way that climate science seems very fucked and we are a one-way ticket to not a good place, in a way that also felt like that 30 years ago for queer people. And we are on a sort of more hopeful trajectory than what it looked like 30 years ago. So I was kind of encouraged by that question of like, what can we learn from those two things? And then the question I have for you is sort of, it's now a year on. Positive experience and negative experience. So what have you been positively surprised by a year on? And the other side, sort of what have you been sort of saddened by or negatively surprised by a year on?
Thanks for that. I think the positive one has just been how, to my perception, and I have no frame of reference, this is my first novel, so I don't know what's normal, I feel like the book's been pretty well received, and I felt very supported by not just like friends and family, but I feel like a lot of people have engaged with this book. I've got loads of messages on like Instagram and stuff by people who've read it and been really moved by it. And I had this weird thing where when I was writing it, I wasn't really thinking about... Sorry, this sounds rude now. I don't know about to say this. But anyway, I wasn't really thinking about the readers. Like, I was... like, and I thank God I wasn't, because I think I would have felt really, like, inhibited by that. But I was kind of writing it, and I was like, I need to get the story out. I want to put the story in the world. And then only when I got, like, a physical copy in my hands, I was like, oh, my God, people are going to read this. Like, what are they going to think? This is... Like, suddenly I just got this, like, hit with this wall of, like, fear. But I think generally people have like responded quite well to it, so I guess that's been really wonderful for me, and like it's vindicated my belief in it, I suppose, as a book. I don't know if I've had any negative like feelings about this in the last year. I think it's been mostly a positive experience. I don't know, Michael. Have I had any downers? I don't know. I think I've been pretty happy about how it's gone.
Apart from the catharsis not being permanent.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would have been nice.
It would have been nice if I could just stop worrying about this stuff from now on.
Yeah.
I guess I would have loved it to be a series by now, but you know. That falls to someone else, to a screenwriter or a...
if anyone knows of anyone.
Can I just ask another question about... I'm just struck by what Fassie said about privilege being quite an isolating experience. I think that's quite relatable, and especially relatable in terms of the two characters that you have in your book. Where you have somebody who's, I mean, obviously three characters, you know, like Viwa is clearly driven by fear, and fear is just as isolating, but but Malcolm's privilege almost puts him in a place where he's alone. He can't identify with people. He literally, you know, that scene where he like sits in the shuttle, what are they called? Like
pods.
Mm-hmm. Pods, yeah.
Pods, and he's like sitting there, nobody else is looking at him, and nobody can engage with this man being stabbed. And on the other hand, Lutando finds a community, he finds a movement that are working together, and then ultimately he finds himself, like that scene where he applies that like golden eyeshadow.
Yeah.
And it's just such a beautiful like arc, right? Yeah, and I guess just how privilege is so damaging. Maybe just you can just reflect on that, like in terms of, especially I guess the Malcolm storyline.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think Fassi was also touching on this. Like Malcolm makes the easier choice a lot of the time. He like chooses not to go to the protest, and he chooses, you know, he's often choosing the path that seems easier at the time, and then he ends up in this place where he's kind of lost touch with the people who meant the most to him. And again, it's also kind of just extrapolating from things and like. Often, like if I go work in a coffee shop or whatever, and you look around, everybody's on their phone, nobody's talking to each other. Like I've seen mothers like ignoring their children because they're on their phone. And like, so I don't think it's that far-fetched to imagine that we'll all just be like looking at stuff in our eyes in the future. And that really fills me with horror, you know, like I find like that's a very lonely thought. And so, yeah, there's this way in which it's almost like we need to not be able to withdraw from society, because we'll choose to withdraw, and then we are sad and isolated and lonely. And it is one of the beautiful things I think that hopefully balances the negativity in this book as well, is that Lutando, as you say, like he is on the wrong side of the wall, and he's living in what many would find like a hellish situation, but like he's managed to find like beautiful relationships, and he and Nicolo support and love each other, and you know, they've got meaning in their lives.
Yeah, he has a strong sense of purpose, which is like completely lacking in Malcolm's life.
Totally. And he keeps looking for meaning in the wrong places, you know, he keeps trying to connect with people, but it doesn't really work, Malcolm, I mean.
Yeah, instead of meaning, he gets like entertainment.
Yes, exactly.
And work. Yeah.
And some sex.
Yeah, and some sex.
just you were mentioning the love between Viwe and Lutando, and just, I mean, it's a very genre-defying book, or difficult to classify, right, as you were saying earlier. But just the one thing that nobody's sort of talked about so far is really the love story. Like it is. I mean, I found the easiest parts to read, the sort of parts that really flow and sweep you along in the sort of emotional core of the book, is that love story and the difficulties of the relationship, and then the post-relationship, you know, what happens in the aftermath, and it's still the echoes of that keep coming through. And I suppose you don't write the blurb on the back.
No.
But it's, I mean, I'm just curious that it's described as these three queer friends in a, you know, it's like a friendship narrative. It's not described as a love story, and it's not, but that is so much the emotional arc of it. And I just wonder if that was a conscious choice to make it that way, rather, if that's how you think of it as well, that framing, or?
I'm terrible at writing blurbs because I find it hard to summarize it all into like a paragraph or two. So, I mean, that's I'm really happy to hear that, because that love story I found quite beautiful, and I made myself cry at points when I was writing it. So I guess it's complicated because there's also, it's not like a love triangle really. And I'm sorry if this is spoilers for anyone who hasn't read it, but
it's kind of a love triangle.
But it's kind of a love triangle. Malcolm's kind of also in love with Lutando. So I guess it's a little bit blurry in terms of like whether it's a friendship or whether it's a love story in terms of, I guess, those characters. Yeah, but with Lutando and Viwe, it is very much a love story, but it's quite a tragic love story.
But it's interesting because we were talking about like Malcolm's inability to be authentic in his world, but I think that's also so interesting in the romantic relationship that like you could read this as like three different paths or attempts at authenticity, and like Lutando is the only one who really succeeds. But what stands in Viwe's way is not privilege, but internalized homophobia. And that means that he can't, he finds it difficult to be affectionate and to be openly loving and comfortable with Lutando's like femininity and like feminine aspects. And it diminishes him. Like, and yeah, so he also struggles to get to the point of being authentic, whereas Lutando was like more freed, like internally freed in that way.
Totally. Although Lutando also has moments of like kind of losing hope and kind of feeling quite despondent, but he is able to bounce back, I guess, because he is able to learn to kind of love himself and feel supported.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
I've got a process question.
Okay.
Because you mentioned earlier that the initial version that you wrote as part of your MFA was quite different to this version. And
yes.
You used the fact that you're coming back to South Africa changed it quite significantly.
Yes.
I'd be curious about that because I had a similar experience of like going away, coming back, and having the coming back experience quite like a powerful moment of like really engaging with what it meant to be here in South Africa.
Mm.
And I really appreciated that.
Mm.
And I'd be curious to have your perspective on that kind of moment.
Yeah, totally. I think it definitely helped my process to move home. I don't know whether I should tell people this. Anyway, an earlier version of this book, the Citadel storyline was in Chicago, and I was like, oh, I don't need to set this in a different country. We have this kind of inequality right here in Cape Town, you know. And so the MFA is a weird process because you're writing all the time and you're reviewing each other's work all the time and you're churning out a short story or a chapter like every 3 weeks and reading each other's work and you're reading 100 novels like in the per year and it's crazy. And then it's almost like it has to percolate, and I almost threw out almost everything that I'd written, and then those ideas kind of resurfaced in a way. So the process, again, was just trial and error. The structure for this book came last to me, and I think the structure is actually what makes it work. Because initially I was telling it all from Milo's timeline and then dropping into backstory, and then that really wasn't working. And I was like, oh, I actually can just go back in time and tell these chunks of storyline in different time periods. Did that answer your question at all?
Okay.
I have a like quite specific question in relation to this, which is, so it's set in Cape Town, but it's got a lot of like geographical specificity that a lot of books don't have. Like, I think it's like very strong on like writing the city. It like mentions street names. There's like, it almost feels like mapped out. Like I can, I can like picture the routes. I'm like, yes, that was a good route. That is indeed the quickest way to get there. Like, it's that kind of specific. So I wanted to know, like, how do you map a book? Like, did you do it mentally? Did you like walk it yourself? Did you,
I don't know. I guess, I mean, I live in the City Ball, and I guess a lot of this book takes place in the City Ball. So I guess I kind of know where everything is in relation to everything else. You mentioned, I think, earlier that at one point the ocean kind of reclaims the land that we reclaimed in, like, I think the 40s, that they built the foreshore and all of that stuff. And so the ocean rises back to Strand Street, which was originally the coastline, which is why it's called Strand Street. And I don't know, I just had quite a lot of fun kind of imagining. There's a lot of, like, playing with time in this. Like, in towards the end, Milo is also kind of almost seeing Cape Town before the arrival of, like, the settlers and all of this stuff. So I had a lot of fun kind of peeling away the layers of history and reimagining what Cape Town would have been like at various points in history. My sense of place, it was quite important to me. Like, I love reading books that are set in cities that I know and I love. One of our professors in MFA like hammered into us that you attain the universal through the specific, which I think is true.
You needed to be in Cape Town for that bit, right? Like,
yes.
You wouldn't have been able to do that in New York.
No,
right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it also was one of the more, I mean, it's quite a heavy book, I guess, but there were some like quite playful elements that were quite fun to write, you know, like imagining like ships like traveling over Beukenkracht Street and stuff like that. You know, it's kind of quite cool to imagine that, even though it's terrifying at the same time.
Yeah.
And there were some like quite specific things that didn't make it into the final version. So there was like a farewell party to a house that they had in an earlier version of this book where like the ocean was rising and they had this like very like decadent, beautiful party on the top floor because the ground floor had been flooded, and you know, it was cool.
I have a question about technology.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have a segue for it, but it's everyone is asking. So the technology, so this is an aspect of the dystopia, which I think the first time I read this, the climate aspect was the thing that hit me like a ton of bricks. This time around, it was the technology. Like, okay, the technological world in this book, like, which is so, like, it's in the very near future. It's so plausible. It feels like we're almost there. And it's things, it's from, like, drones recognizing Dutando at the protest. And then instead of him being arrested, what happens is that a misinformation and like deep faking campaign is run against him, like videos of him saying problematic things that will alienate him from like his fellow people on the left. And then there's the fact that, like, the augmented reality components, like the chips that people get inserted. So all of the things that we do with our phones can happen directly on your eyeballs or like on something that only you can see. And then the tuning out where people have like do not disturb sitting on their faces where they can't see the world around them. And then also like the shock of like when that's removed, how long it takes for the brain to recover. It's just, it's so hectic. It's so close to what we have now. And it made me like, I don't know, like more hopeless than the climate stuff did. Partly because like, I don't know, like with climate, we know what needs to be done, right? Like it's just not being done. But with this technology, like it's like a bulldozer. Like, I don't know how what it looks like to stop it or like how to stop the momentum. So the one question is like, do you know? And then the second question is like, because you're so good at writing technology, like to the point of like, everything is like branded. It like has a concept doc. Like it's so well thought out. Like there's, I mean, I'm going to give some more of like what the technology is. So one of the things is that people's dreams are recorded and then you can like experience their dreams. And then Malcolm figures out a system of archetype tagging where things can be two things at once. So like you see someone in a dream, but, and they're like, I don't know, they look like your high school English teacher, but like the archetype is the love of your life. And they're both things at once. And you experience that when you experience someone's dreams. So good. So there's all these things like such good ideas and interesting ideas. Malcolm's project, this isn't really a spoiler because it's not, I don't think it's, yeah. So he works on a project that tags your memories as traumatic or not. And then like files them away in a way that they like stop bothering you. And then like it gets to the point where you can even have like when you're experiencing something negative in real life, like that can be altered as you're experiencing it so that you only experience good things. Like, all very interesting stuff. So like, why are you so good at coming up with like new technologies that are very well, I don't know, thought out, good names?
That's hilarious. I don't know, but thank you. So I guess I used to work for like a branding and marketing company. That might help. So I think that, yeah, like, and I was often like looking at trend forecasts and things like that. So like you kind of get a knack for like the catchy names that people come up with and these new kinds of tech. It was also an area of the book where I allowed myself to have quite a lot of fun of just like imagining, like taking these current things that we have and extrapolating into the future and having a bit of fun with that. The sort of nightmare tagging and experience filtering and all of that stuff, I guess was more because I wanted to look at the mental health aspects of what we're going through and that there is a rise in anxiety and depression and all of these things and our various ways of tackling that and how it's often kind of the approach is often to just think, oh, well, wouldn't it be amazing to just like remove the trauma or remove the memory or all of that stuff. So there was, I think tech, like all the things that drug companies do for us now, I think tech will do for us in the future. And that's sure. Terrifying.
It's terrifying.
And in terms of like, I don't know how we stop it. I guess I just hope after reading this book, people are more kind of conscious about it and more, because I think we have this blind faith in technology and we think it's going to solve all of our problems and we don't need to change anything because tech is going to change the things for us. And Elon Musk wants to put a sail in front of the sun to like dim the heat of the sun and all of these things, rather than actually just like changing our consumption patterns and all of these things. You know, we always think tech is going to be the solution. So I guess I'm just hoping to show some of the scarier sides of tech and some of the fun sides of tech, so that we are more skeptical of it and we don't just blindly accept whatever is pushed on us as like better because it's newer, you know. It's not necessarily better.
Oof. Yeah, a lot of the promises end up being really empty.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what is your like emotional valence to these kinds of technological innovations? And I'm thinking about like your emotional valence of like your experience of tech. So, and I'm thinking about like phone tech, like things that we currently are doing on our cell phones, yeah. Like social media and like, do you feel excited or afraid or fascinated or like, where do you find yourself on? Because I just feel like scared and useless in response.
Yeah, I'm probably more on the scared and useless side of things too. No, and I know from myself how hard I find it to not be distracted by my phone and to like look away. And I just read, Stolen Focus last year.
Yes.
and how difficult it is to not be on our phones all the time and how it's sort of built into the economic model of these companies to get us onto our phone all, for as many hours a day because that's how they make their money. Yeah, I guess it's a kind of nuanced answer because I a lot of it does really scare me, but then I also think this technology also does amazing things for us, right?
Yeah.
And like, I think also in this book, someone wins this as a prize, but like these little, I've not gone blank on the name, but like
nanobots
that can like kill, like eat cancer cells and that stuff. So there are like amazing advances in technology as well that do improve our lives. It's just that we just assume everything that new is going to improve our life, and I don't think that's true.
Mm.
And I'm very terrified since this book came out by this whole ChatGPT thing and how like a lot of occupations are going to be made redundant. Sorry. Yeah.
No, you're the author.
No. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I
think one of the interesting things about what you said was about how the things that really are scary is where it's almost part of capitalism and where it's like a commercialized technology.
Yeah.
And I guess you also touch on that in relation to the climate change elements of the book as well, where you're like, we need to consume less and capitalism is driving this. And I think you've spoken about this before, how capitalism as a system is part of the problem.
Mm.
I guess, do you think that in terms of technology as well, is that one of the ways in which we could maybe fix it, is to divorce it from its capitalist roots?
Yeah. So I do think capitalism is causing this crisis, definitely. And it's, I think, one of the reasons we feel a bit overwhelmed and a bit hopeless, because we're sort of individuals rather than members of any kind of larger group. And so, like, the only influence we can have is by... Sorry, I shouldn't do air quotes if this is being recorded, right? I was doing air quotes.
that's how you do it, John.
The only influence we can have is, like, through our individual purchase decisions and that kind of stuff, which is, you know, also just not true. Like, we're tricked into thinking the only influence we have is our power as consumers or as... consumers, I guess. And I think that's... I don't know how you would do that. I don't know how you divorce capitalism from technological advancement, but I think it would be helpful if we could do that, because a lot of the motives behind these technologies is not necessarily in our best interests. And if there's a way to sort of power innovation in a way that was more socially focused or social justice focused, that would be amazing. You know?
I really enjoyed reading the book, and well, it's pretty dark. I must say, I read it over like 4 days. Towards the end, I needed a break, I think. But it was really nice reading. And I was wondering, I'm not sure this is done as asking a writer, but towards the end, I thought when the dome was sort of, you know, the hole was there, I was like, okay, this is the end. Now finally the have-nots will come and take it out of them and, you know, beat them up, and that's the end. Sort of justice is served. But you decided that it's not the end. Yeah, I don't know. I'm doing spoilers yet. Why not? Yes. But I was wondering whether or not you considered that, or whether you decided to go more for the personal story. Because I kind of like that, actually, because I thought it was almost more dramatic than an almost stereotypical end of like end of civilization, and that's it. But I don't know whether you considered that.
Yeah, thanks for that. I did think about that, and for me, it felt too easy almost to have the dome come down and, you know, there to be sort of justice served or the have-nots to storm in. I didn't want to let the reader off the hook so easily. Like, I didn't want it to feel resolved. And so this book has quite an ambiguous ending, which some people love, some people really hate. They've told me so. But I guess I want it to kind of live on in the minds of readers, and for it to not be fully resolved, and like, what happened to some of the people who we don't know what happened to them, to haunt you. And maybe it's easy to say this, but I think because I feel like this is a part cautionary tale and part love story, part all of these things, I guess part of what I was going for with the ending was that the ending is as bad as we let it get. Like, what, like how we respond now and what we do now is going to determine how, what the ending of this book will be like.
Do you have another question?
I don't know if it's a question, it might be a good comment. It's just a parallel that's popped into my mind as you said. There's like, I imagine a lot of white people in 1994 thought the glass had just shattered down
yeah.
their little bubble.
Yeah.
That's, I don't know, it's popped to my mind and it feels very intense. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure.
Okay, so I'm going to end it with, so because we're talking about like a dystopia, we're talking about all the these like hectic things that might happen and have already started happening. And so I want to end it on something called an obligatory note of hope. So this is something that comes from Jenny Offel's very good book, Weather, which is also Cli-Fi. And it's about this woman who, she responds to the emails of a climate change professor. Like, that's her job. And then she, one of the rules of her job is that she has to end every email with an obligatory note of hope. So, Alistair, what is our note of hope that we can end on?
Oh, no pressure. I'm just solve all of the problems of the world. So, I guess... Yeah, I guess, I mean, I don't have all the answers. Like, I don't think anyone, one person has all the answers. What I hope the book does is inspire people to be more active about these things and be less apathetic about it, to realize that it's quite serious what we're heading towards, but that it's not too late. You know, that's kind of the whole premise of the title. To remember that we're not alone in fighting this. I think one of the things that I hope comes through in this book is the power of relationships and friendships and being there for each other. You know, it kind of became so clear to me in COVID when the whole world shut down around us. It's like the people in our lives are kind of all that matters. And so the characters in this book do support one another and help each other regain some sort of drive and emphasis. And even though it does feel overwhelming and that we don't have that much power as individuals, but we don't have to be individuals. We can pair up, we can form movements, we can join protests, we can petition governments. And like on a... we can get solar installed if we can afford it. and like one of the things that really helps me, like I touched on it earlier, but is kind of getting my hands like literally dirty, like planting trees. Actually, it's such a small thing we can do, but it actually has quite a big impact on like the heat in the city. It reduces the heat. Each adult tree can absorb however many kilograms of CO2. So there are ways of being active while acknowledging that we need kind of system change and a whole economic restructuring of the world. That is a huge task, and I'll leave that to the economists, but there are things we can do, I think, that really help in the meantime.
You can actually buy Alice's book and then he will plant a tree.
Yay.
Oh, yeah, you're doing that, right? You
I'm
have to plant
that,
a tree
yeah.
for every book that's
I'm
bought.
I'm
going to
plant a tree for every book
okay.
that's bought. Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
In the month of April.
Yeah.
We can start now if anyone wants
now.
To buy.
It's up to you.
Why not?
That was
yeah.
perfect. Thank you, Alistair. Thank you so much for doing this event with me.
Oh, thank you so much for hosting me. I love this. Thanks.
If you haven't bought the book, please buy it. There are copies. If you have bought the book, buy it for a friend. Because Alistair's planting trees. Very altruistic. Okay. Oh, yes.
Yeah,
we'll do some signings.
I've got my pen, yeah.
I have a couple of thank yous. First, thank you to Alistair. Thank you to you, everyone, for coming. Thank you to the Book Lounge for hosting, and also the Book Lounge, even though the podcast is now funded by the National Arts Council, which is another thank you. Thank you to the National Arts Council. but the Book Lounge still helps us out in a lot of ways. They give me knowledge, they lend me books, and they give me the space and many other things. Thanks to the Army, who's my main contact with the Book Lounge. And then thanks to Andrea, who's left now, but she's our producer and editor, and she helped me set up, and she helps make everything. And then we're going to go to Roxy's after this to keep the conversation going. So if you're keen to join for a drink and a chat, I mean, we can't talk about this, but we can also talk about other things. Yeah. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Listen to readers' communities.
Yes,
thank you, Michael. I should have said that. Thanks to everyone who attended the event, to the Book Lounge for hosting, and to Alistair for his wonderful presence. I'm your host, Fasti Karlitz. Also on our team is Andrew Burnett, our producer and editor, Kelly Eve Quipman, who is our assistant producer and researcher, and Simone Rademeyer, who has helped with the editing. This event, as well as the whole season, was made possible by funding from the National Arts Council. Join us for the final episode of the season, featuring Jared Thompson and with recommendations from Kelly Eve Quipman. Until then, keep reading.